Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey guys, gotta be super snippy with this one. I'm on the road right now. As you can tell by my lack of microphone rig and my terrible background, the internet's a little spotty, so I'm gonna get right into it. Today's episode is with Mark Bergen. He's the author of Like, Comment, Subscribe, Inside YouTube's Chaotic Rise to World Domination. It's Friday, so we also have the Substack going out. And if you enjoyed this conversation or anything else you've listened to recently or this week, you should go to our Supercast to support the show, realignment.supercast.com. Hope you all enjoy this conversation. We'll be back with more content next week. Hope you enjoy the episode. Mark Bergen, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Really great to speak with you. I really enjoyed the book. I can't recommend it enough to listeners slash viewers, which is particularly apt given the conversation today is about YouTube. But let's just start with something that I really appreciated from your description of the company. Can you just talk about how truly revolutionary us just being able to record this over Zoom, upload it pretty quickly? Honestly, I've got Google Fiber, so it would be up within, 5 minutes. Just talk about the revolutionary nature of what YouTube at its core level was doing.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I don't think we appreciate it enough. I certainly don't and didn't before researching the book. How new this is. So 2005 is when YouTube is formed, around the same time as Facebook. There was file video sharing on the internet. Part of the catalyst for the company was that it was pretty clunky or expensive. One of the Steve Chen is a founding co-founder of YouTube and recalled having to, spending so much time where he'd upload these kind of 4-second clips and just try to make sure that his mouth was moving the same time as the note, like syncing the audio and visual files, was a big engineering lift. And the fact that YouTube was savvy enough to make their video player embeddable elsewhere on the internet was a major reason why it took off and for its success. I think it's certainly people at the time didn't know that free on-demand video would be a thing. Certainly would be the scale to the size it is. And so much of the company's focus was on making, there were times early on when YouTube went down. It is rare now that we ever have a shortage or even have to wait a millisecond before your video starts playing. And that's part of the resources that Google has plugged into it in the past 17 years.
Can you talk about the scale here? So for example, 1 billion hours of content is watched every single day on YouTube. Like how just big is that scale? And how does that compare to, let's say, what people were watching on television in the early 2000s or even 1990s with cable?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit not apples to apples, but just the hours, part of the YouTube set that goal for 1 billion hours a day around late 2011, 2012. And as I talk about in the book, the major driver behind that decision was YouTube had grown pretty significantly, sort of defeated all its web video competitors. But it looked at television, and at the time, 4 to 5 hours of Americans' day was spent on TV. And YouTube had maybe five minute chunks that was sort of the 5 to 7 minutes was the average daily consumption time. And so in YouTube's perspective, they are still the underdog to television. Television eats up a majority of people's time and has. It eats up, more importantly for the company, a bulk of the marketing dollars. TV marketers and brands still go to TV, or sorry, marketers still go to TV, despite the fact that digital has been this growing force for a long time. And that's I think it's an important thing for readers to remember. And it's this interesting whiplash in the book where YouTube has always seen itself as this underdog. And then in the past few years, now it's being equated with big tech and all the ills of Silicon Valley. And I think that's a really interesting tension.
Here's where I like a book where it is half personal development, career advice, and also just learning about the world. Like, what do you guys, like me and you, what should our reaction to YouTube be? Let me get the context, right? So you're at Bloomberg, obviously like prestige journalism outlet. I spent a lot of time in DC think tank world. I'm a fellow at a think tank. I spent like 2 years raising money to launch a podcast because I needed all this credibility and I needed to be secure. But at the same time, we can just hop on and just post this video. And this is something that I didn't really comprehend until a few months ago when I saw that there are all these folks in especially like foreign policy and energy related spaces who just have no legitimate credentials, just to be frank, like no legitimate credentials. They're clearly doing like a lot of like research on the fly, but they're putting together videos that get a lot of views and the work is getting better and better and better. So how do you just kind of like think about that from the perspective of like what skill sets like matter like as a journalist? Like what is journalism right now? Like what is Bloomberg's value add for you relative to you just being like a writer on your own, putting out YouTube videos about YouTube? How do you personally think through this?
Let me draw a more sort of mundane comparison here. Like I'm sure we've all watched a cooking channel on YouTube or a workout video, right? Like, so during the pandemic, you know, I started because didn't go to the gym, started to just go on YouTube and search for like certain types of workouts, right? And then typically I click on the most popular one up in the beginning of my search results. And it after a while you watch enough, you kind of trust or you like a certain vibe of a creator, but you really have no sense of their expertise, right? Unless they're you do that kind of homework to go out and find. And I'm watching these tips and I'm like, is this person really telling me how to work out correctly? Right. And it's sort of, you know, YouTube is part of Google. I think that I know the company operates YouTube as a search engine primarily, and like they sort of think like Google thinks. It's the same rules and principles for Google in the sense that there's a search result at the top of your Google page, you know, the company's had a lot of change around news, politics, health, financial issues, like these certain topics that have a lot more significance. YouTube was delayed in that respect for a variety of reasons, but Google has put a lot of resources and work in part because of the scrutiny the company's faced to, oh, we're going to actually put experts and authoritative sources higher up in the rankings. And so people are, when they're searching for something about health related or you name it, the idea is that Google wants to deliver accurate quality information, but you know, this is the same. So I guess that roundabout way of getting to your answer, you know, I think starting off, that was the premise of YouTube and revolutionary at the time, right? Anyone can set up a green screen and be a TV anchor. Anyone can come on and be a political commentator. I think that has had some profoundly important and influential role in reshaping the news media. What you've seen so YouTube do in the past few years is sort of scramble to respond to criticism about misinformation and propaganda, is algorithmically promote things like Bloomberg, for instance, is an authoritative news source. Now, YouTube is not very clear and transparent about what is authoritative, what they deem authoritative and what they don't. And those that are authoritative are higher up in search rankings and recommendations. That being said, I think so, you know, you and I could go up and post a YouTube video tomorrow, not under Bloomberg, but just under Mark Bergen. The odds and say that I'm an expert on what have you, the odds of me getting an audience without a lot of YouTube subscribers built in is pretty low. And so, you know, YouTube is both giving independent creators and sort of non-experts this leg up. But at the same time, as the book shows, like this, the history of the company is really to like push and help and sort of tilted towards traditional media because they have the resources to put out things more consistently with higher production value, all the sort of signals that YouTube tends to promote more. And so I think it's been this really interesting tension of the company. And there's certainly a lot of disagreement about it internally about, you know, how much are we going to be promoting traditional media versus sort of the independent creators? In an area like news and politics, they have shifted way towards traditional media. And the pendulum has swung a lot in the past few years. In part because of it, just that they were being dragged before Congress and so much criticism and advertisers and all those that the book gets into with sometimes excruciating detail.
You know, it's interesting. You're speaking to a tension here. I wonder if you could explain what like the popular mythos of Twitter, of not Twitter, of YouTube, like what it actually is, because it seems like these tech companies get in trouble when there is a myth. Let's say Jack Dorsey saying Twitter is the free speech wing of the free speech party, when Twitter needs to start cracking down, I think rightfully in some cases, poorly in other cases, it's complicated as these things are. That leads to conflict with their actual user base because they're like, what the heck? This is supposed to be the Wild West. Why is it not like that? What is YouTube's like equivalent understanding of itself? And how do actual users understand what YouTube actually is?
That's a really good question. I think, you know, the YouTube is what's so unique about it, from Twitter and Facebook, it's one is that it has this economic dynamic that the other platforms don't have, right? It pays creators, it pays producers, and that has all sorts of complications of actually like Google going to business with millions of people. So the company sort of sees itself really, you know, especially more recently, they've been talking a lot. We're an education platform. We're a learning, you know, sometimes during a conference a few years ago, Susan Wojcicki, the CEO of YouTube, said, you know, YouTube's a music service. And everyone in the audience is like, really? But it is the world's largest music platform by far. I don't know if by far, but it is. And the company's been trying to compete with Spotify and Apple. It is all things to all people in many ways. I think the company's mythos, to answer your question, is that this is generally a platform that's useful. Has like it's a place like Google. It's got useful information, how-to videos. It's, you know, it's got whole entire categories that don't exist in traditional entertainment, like gaming and beauty tutorials. That's the view of the company. You know, Google thinks about things in data. And so they've said this to refute a lot of the criticism about how they handle political content. I'm like, oh, news and politics is very small, which is true in like proportionally. It is unlike Facebook, I think, a much smaller percentage of the platform overall. You know, you go look at the top Facebook posts, it's typically like, we've seen all these posts before, like it's really engaging and sometimes really heated political posts. On YouTube, it is gaming, it is kids content, it is beauty. Still, there is a very robust and sizable conversation about politics happening every day on YouTube. So I think that's a bit of the discrepancy between, I think the company sees itself one way and the platform just continually drives in another.
And this is where the conversation with the algorithm starts to matter more. What is the fact that YouTube skews away from news and politics, is that a organic reality or is that a decision that's been made on YouTube's part? Because obviously advertising's business model here, news and politics, especially video, is not ideal relative to a gaming channel, relative to that. I mean, I'm sure that workout, the videos you're watching there, that's great advertising content. An advertiser would love to be put there. They wouldn't want to see you and I like debating the nuances of COVID lockdown policy if they're having to choose between which ones they're advertising on. So what's going on there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing about the I discovered in reporting the book was that wasn't always the case. There was early on, YouTube had a community manager who his job was to work on news and politics. And YouTube has much leaned in on this in a way that's sort of remarkable for us to think about now. The 2008 Democratic debates, they set it up with CNN. YouTubers were asking the questions.
Man, that's so 2008. It's not even funny. I actually kind of remember that. Like younger listeners like won't have seen this, but it was very 2000s, very aughts.
There was there was a question about Arnold Schwarzenegger and nuclear deterrence. There were some goofy questions, but some legitimate ones. And it was a lot of candidates launched their announcement on YouTube. And it was sort of like Bill Clinton playing the saxophone on Arsenio Hall, right? That's the new thing they were leaning into. And, you know, YouTube then had with Obama, they had YouTubers, select marquee YouTubers interview him. A very vetted, very careful. But these were the kind of, this was around the time that YouTube was like, oh, we have these creator bases and there are stars. We're going to turn them into commercial, mainstream, marketable personalities. I think ever since 2016, you know, the company has just, for a variety of reasons, but mostly because it's just being with regulation and politics has become much more radioactive. I think even before then, we saw the Arab Spring was this really big moment. Where YouTube, like Facebook and Twitter, leaned in, and they were, you know, this is where they're going to be. They're the tools that are taking down dictators. They partnered with this company called Storyful, and I have this interesting story in the book, which I think has been unexplored. But at one point, you know, someone told me the feedback from YouTube was like, okay, this whole death channel thing is like not, you know, the kids aren't loving it, and to your point, advertisers aren't loving it, and that stuff became set up YouTube's like biggest economic and financial crisis was around videos that were some of them extremist, but some of them touching on politics in a way that advertisers were like, we just want no part in this whatsoever.
I think you're getting to the core of, I think, the issue, if you're looking at this from the outsider's perspective. How much is the decision around news and politics and bias about ideology, bias, like implicit or otherwise, or how much is just like, this is a business that wants to make money? Because I always turn into Google shill when I'm like explaining to people, like maybe on the right, who say like this company, I'm like, yeah, I think it's that like this stuff is toxic and they want to make money. How, to what degree do you think is this like the underlying dynamic?
So in the book makes clear, like, and I think there's, this is undeniable. Like YouTube does have certain values based on its employees and historically, I think a lot of it was like politically naive, but like gay and transgendered issue, like they want to be out in the forefront of this. Like they were much more active on Prop 8 in I think 2007, 2008. They've been pretty active environmental issues, like, you know, especially around after George Floyd, the, you know, YouTube was like many companies kind of came out around racial justice and the, inside the company, right. There's this idea that Hollywood has gatekeepers, and which is very true. And like the Hollywood gatekeepers have kept certain people out, of media for a variety of reasons. And like YouTube is this, to our earlier conversation, like a way to a great equalizer. In some ways. And I think that's the mythos around the company, is they see themselves like that. Whether or not that's borne out in the numbers is unclear. I think, yes, to your point, it is an advertising company. They typically make decisions, you know, to respond to shareholders and respond to business demands. And more recently, Google's becoming a very cautious and conservative company. They are facing unprecedented antitrust action at the federal level and the state level. They just, my sense from people inside is like, is in YouTube too, like everything in the past few years has been like, they move very slowly. They have a lot of people involved with every single decision. That is because it has ramifications for millions of creators who are making money. And now this new constituency, which is, it has ramifications for regulators and politicians. So I think that, you know, their bias is almost towards like small C conservative, or like they're just biased towards not taking a lot of action and not and I think the criticism from the business community sometimes, and you hear this from startups world, is like YouTube doesn't really innovate that quickly. And it's true. They're a tanker and they take very, very small turns.
Well, it's funny. We're going to jump around a bunch of different places because I think this is just such a great topic. But to your point near the start of the book, YouTube comes out of the same social media space as Facebook, Reddit, Dig, some successful, some unsuccessful companies, but it really has just such a staying power relative to the competition. Like obviously Facebook is still printing money, you know, within the context of the space, but there's definitely been a huge crash amongst younger, even like middle millennial persons such as myself. What explains YouTube's consistency just across decades?
I think one is they set up a business model as flawed as it is. You know, since 2007, they've been paying broadcasters, paying creators.
And what's flawed about that?
Yeah, the flawed part is what in the book gets into that. You know, that is when advertisers, there was a series in 2017 of boycotts, right, around extremist issues, around inappropriate kids content. The flawed part being they didn't set up the right safeguards in place to moderate that. They, I think, arguably gave a lot more trust to their creators than they probably should have and certainly have peeled back that and changed that policy dramatically and like reduced the number of channels they can make ads and then set in a bunch of new rules that didn't exist originally. So it, like anything to do with creators has been complicated. You're setting up this effectively like a gig economy with millions of people who are relying on money from the company, but you know, not directly employed with them. And YouTube, just because of its scale and the way the company operates, like they're not good with managing people. So a majority of YouTubers, if their channel's removed, they don't have ads running on a channel, they'll get an automated email and like no way to talk to a human being. So I think that is a very flawed system. That being said, it is a system that kept people posting. it kept people on. It is like even now where TikTok is the first real platform to compete with YouTube on paying creators. You know, you talk to a lot of creators, TikTok is not so far, and that could just be early, that could change, but you know, they go on TikTok to get discovered, to have fun, to experiment. YouTube is where you make money. And consistently it's been the one place, the gold standard for the creator economy. And I think that's a major reason why it succeeded. Vine, if you go back a few years ago, was this hot new thing. YouTube was scared about it. Mm-hmm. Vine couldn't figure out a way to actually sustainably pay creators. Part of the reason it went to Twitter and then dissolved and collapsed. Instagram and Facebook, for different reasons, has never just tried many different times and just hasn't quite figured this out. So I think that, you know, it's the key reason. Another one is that YouTube is part of Google, and Google's has massive resources, has the world's, you know, leading computer science and artificial intelligence, and it's the biggest digital advertiser in the world. So they just have this machinery in place that can sustain a force like YouTube.
You know, it's interesting as you're describing this, if I'm thinking of my YouTube experience, which started about my freshman year of high school, it's remarkably consistent. So obviously the typeface has been updated. Things look a little different. There's been the addition of products like Shorts and those different bits, but it's basically the same thing. Like unlike Facebook, right? Like remember 2007 to 2011, where you'd have like every 8 months, a Mark Zuckerberg has changed our wall. And I hate that. It's just so inconsistent. And then you have obviously the recent Instagram debate about how they structure the feed. So it's more TikTok like rather than that. Two questions then. So A, do you think the consistency plays a part in just continuing to capture and retain users? And then B, has the platform been as consistent at a design level, right? Like we're getting into YouTube Red and the premium and those things like an aside, but about consistency compared to its, not its competitors, but its like fellow tech titans.
Sure. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Like they've not been consistent around business strategy. And certainly, you know, if you're a creator, like they're not consistent around the algorithm and what it sort of wants and demands from you. But it has been consistent around design and user experience. And that was a part of the early genius there, is it's a pretty simple interface. Everyone can figure out, it's kind of universal now, like click on that triangle play button. And, I think that they're, that's like a very useful constraint for them, and has been a major reason. And Google, to its credit, has not done what Facebook's doing with Instagram, right? It's not like YouTube brought to you by Google. And in part, that's because Google has so much success with its search business. But it's let YouTube more or less operate by itself. There are important moments. So the book talks a lot about if people remember the euphoria around Google+, when Google was trying to build its own social network and inside YouTube, I learned that was like the biggest headache for people working there was Google+. but they have to fight back from the mothership. A lot of ideas that today we could say were terrible. And so I think that is, you're absolutely right, that the sense that that's been a major driver for their success.
Something I wonder about is just like the nature of popularity. When we're discussing all the things. So for example, this is another area of tension. We're talking about that, you know, the YouTube video that had the most views. Part of the reason why I didn't just start a podcast, quote unquote, and start posting is I had to go to PBS first, where I learned how to book good guests such as yourself. There's this like tension there. And then there's obviously the algorithm. I've experienced the difference between a YouTube. This is an audio first podcast, so I don't put that much work into YouTube, but I've just experienced that like day where the algorithm caught you. And when you get 350,000 views for an interview in a week versus let's say 10,000, it's just sort of like, holy crap. But like, can you just speak? So like, just speak about just popularity, like within that context, because it's not actually a race, because there's an algorithm. There's no gatekeeper, but it kind of feels like there is a gatekeeper at the same time. So how do you just reflect on all of that? It's jumbled, but that's kind of the point.
Yeah, I think there are creators who've been on YouTubers for a very long time. And it's sort of everyone who's a big enough YouTuber, that the trope is like you make a video about YouTube and the audience, and there are exceptionally smart creators who have made videos about this that I like totally just I'm very thankful for. They were, and I cited them in the book, but they're extremely helpful resources. One of them is the channel's name is Veritasium, and it's a science channel, and he does great stuff. And he made this video, I want to say it was pre-pandemic, but maybe like 2019, looking at some science around expertise. And forgive me, Derek, because I might butcher this, but his name's Derek Mueller. The idea was that there was this social science around, here are the three things you need to be an expert at something. You need to have a lot of practice, was one of them. And then I think you have like another one was consistent conditions, right? And YouTubers certainly have a lot of chance to practice if you're posting up all the time and they post video after video, right? Like sometimes daily or weekly over a long stretch of career, that's a lot of practice. You know, YouTube has ways for you to kind of A-B test headlines and thumbnails. But his point was that there's never any consistency. And there's this idea that like, oh, I get that. Like I had that big hit. I should be able to continue to pump out big hit. I only need the YouTube is sort of built to, you will continue to grow. And here are the ways that, and there's a playbook for you to continue to grow. And the onus is sort of on you to do so. You know, in the history of YouTube, there were these multi-channel networks, that kind of these YouTube studios that came up about a decade ago, that actually started to manage talent, because in the beginning, YouTube had like somewhat, they had some people on staff that had a relationship with creators, but it wasn't really talent management, in part because they didn't actually think that creators, there was no concept of what a creator was, or that people would build new businesses and careers on YouTube. And so they sort of outsourced the management part. They've gotten a little bit better at that. Patreon is a really fascinating example. Patreon is a company that formed affected by a YouTuber that was like, I put in so much money into my videos and the economics just don't work out, right? Mm-hmm. Like even if it's a big hit. And so he built this site that does like a patronage model where fans can come on and pay. And the idea is that, you know, talk to YouTubers who love and use Patreon, and every video doesn't need to be a viral hit. I don't need to continue to strive. I can like have a comfortable audience. And, you know, we're seeing that with Substack, because it's sort of the same way, right? Like the internet's kind of moving to, oh, what about these communities that we don't need just to push for a massive scale, and we can have a tailored audience. And in that way, I think make videos that are appealing to your fans, not just the masses. I think YouTube, just by its nature, is always going to be appeal to the masses.
I want to talk then about gatekeeping, pluses and minuses. There's this interesting, I can't remember who tweeted this, but there's just like articulation of, and this is an anti-gatekeeping take. If you really think of popular culture in the 1950s, like how much of this stuff is actually good, and how much of it was there was a bunch of like white dudes who worked at the New Yorker who said, we think this is great. And now we've got a system where you kind of you hear this and you're like, oh man, this is so much better. But there's an algorithm, and I definitely know big creators, I'm sure you've spoken with big creators, who are not doing their best artistic work, who are playing to an algorithm. They're always like different bits. So can you just like reflect on what we've learned about the anti-gatekeeping narrative, the pluses and minuses, now that we're this far into the game? It's not 2012 anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I'll put my cards on the table, in the sense that I'm a gatekeeper and I work in traditional media. And which is, the criticisms are all legitimate about traditional media. Like largely white and college, like a select number of universities and colleges, and nepotistic and all that good stuff. And so I think that's incredibly valid and fair. And you have creators that especially during the worst moment in the they call it the adpocalypse in 2017, where because of the way that YouTube is structured, some Disney, for example, they have their own ad sales team and they can go out and sell ads, and advertisers are like, this is Disney stuff appearing on, you know, Disney owns ABC. So Jimmy Kimmel on YouTube, not going to be worried about something because it's already on TV. And so you had Jimmy Kimmel, this like really potent example, Jimmy Kimmel talking about this mass shooting, and his video runs ads. And then you have Casey Neistat, who's one of the biggest YouTubers in the world, talking about the same mass shooting. His video is demonetized because YouTube was at the time, like, we just wanted to, they set their filters so strictly. That is a form of gatekeeping in a way, right? Like, and YouTube is changes the rules right around, especially the most recent, like they've changed the rules around COVID. They've changed the rules around elections, like what you can and cannot talk about with elections. And that is responding to the threat of regulation, real regulation. It is still a gatekeeping function, right? Like YouTube mm-hmm. is from day one, despite what the company says, it's sort of we're this mirror to the world. And like, there's been no graphic sex in porn. Like say there are OnlyFans there right now that has just been capitalizing on this. And I think that was a smart decision, business, certainly from YouTube, like, and a difficult one in the sense that they had to initially like so many of the resources to like fight porn. Mm-hmm. But that is a kind of gatekeeping. It's a choice they made where they wanted their platform to look a certain way and not look another way. And they made a series of those choices and continue to do so. So I think it's just gatekeeping by a different name.
So this is interesting though. So to your point, YouTube is a Google company and it's the second biggest search engine. You can get to porn on Google very, very, very quickly. It's one main search engine. So why actually can't you have porn? I feel like I know why you can't, but like, why can't you have porn on YouTube in the same way that it's a search engine?
Yeah, I think early on the decision was they didn't want to be like the schlock kind of e-bombs world, and like porn and chucks was associated with kind of the early web video was a backwatery place, right? Like,
digital porn like drove the development of video.
Oh
online.
Yeah, for sure.
So
yeah,
like, that's.
I think even before it was an advertising business, I think that was just part of a decision they made to kind of set themselves apart. There's a fun bit in the book about the decision, the debate they had internally with this Robin Thicke video called Blurred Lines.
Oh, there was the explicit version.
Yeah, he made a video with supermodels cavorting topless in the video, and this would be, I think it's fair criticism from if you're a YouTuber that doesn't work for a record label and you produce that video, that is coming down. Like, you cannot show topless women, but like Robin Thicke can, because he has this loophole of artistic, like that was an artistic video. Mm-hmm. And so YouTube, like what is YouTube, sort of has these rules around, they have pretty strict, they've more strict than before harassment policies and cyberbullying policies. They've carved out an exemption for if it's scripted satire, you can do cyberbullying or it won't be taken down. That is that is a squishy subjective line. And it probably, as much as YouTube wants, like that is not something that a machine can recognize. And often that like 10 people in a room can agree on. In part, maybe it was just how do you define sexual graphic material is something they deal with on a constant level, because there's always this cat and mouse game where creators are going right up to the line. An early example in the book that it was kind of morbidly funny, not morbidly, but like grossly funny, was octopus, like pack octopuses involved in sex act. It was like this very popular trend out of Asia that YouTube's early team was like, how the hell do we moderate this, right?
How do they end up deciding?
My understanding is like depends on how much of it is shown, and it was the early team, to their credit, were sort of inventing this on the fly, but so much of it is judgment calls from people there about which I think it's fair. It was their platform, right? Like it was a community of this was before it was the only place really for online video. And I think that's it gets into antitrust conversations, but like we think about, YouTube as being a censor in the sense that once they take something down, it's effectively off mm-hmm. as a video on the internet because of their size.
I'm realizing as you articulate this too, there are like two very obvious reasons why YouTube wouldn't have porn. So A, like the one you kind of hit at, like if you start, it's one thing if YouTube launched, like, because Twitter, I mean, this was recently reported, like Twitter was thinking about like having like an OnlyFans type feature. Twitter like allows porn. But if YouTube had allowed porn from the start, to your point, that would have defined the platform in a very, we would have called YouTube not like everyone could post on YouTube. Man, this is the greatest porn search engine of all time. So that's a branding disaster.
I mean, they called it YouTube Red was their name for their subscription service, which was really funny because people at the company were like, do we know there's a popular website? I mean, another early example that came out is they were trying, and before Google bought them in October of 2006. Before then, they were trying to do a deal with Disney. It was a marketing deal. And Disney execs discovered that like some porn had sort of these thumbnails of porn that YouTube had removed, but it was still cached on the website. And so Disney was sort of threatening to walk from that. So part of it was just that early on, YouTube was not a legitimate platform and they wanted media companies to partner, to put their stuff on YouTube, to buy ads. And so like they couldn't do that with GraphicsX. Maybe they could today, but like, so that was a key reason why.
Yeah. And then this is like a theme, I think, of both the book, but also the conversation. Like, structure is so important here. Like, I started by comparing, you can get to porn on Google, but Google sends you different places. So it's not as if Google, you search and then there's like listing, like for you're playing on a Google player, Google is sending you other places. So it's actually, this is why it's like I'm not technical, but like structural design seems to dictate so many different like so no one says like, man, like Google is full of porn, because no, Google's sending you to like RedTube. But in the case of YouTube, if you're watching it all on YouTube's proprietary player, then no, it actually like is full of porn, and an advertiser would have a problem there. So that's a way to think about it.
And it's also, that was, you hit on something in one of the earliest moments, as soon as, you know, YouTube before Google didn't have offices in many countries. And so they didn't have to necessarily, like, there's a funny example about, you know, Germany would send YouTube these notifications because Germany has laws about denying the Holocaust and Germany in videos, and YouTube didn't have an office in Germany. So like, we don't need to, the term that someone put up on a staffer put up on the sign was, you know, do not appease the Germans. and it was part of this culture, really early YouTube and the internet was standing up to governments. And then YouTube joins Google. Google has offices in Germany. Google has offices everywhere. Immediately becomes this incredibly harder problem for Google's lawyers, because to your point, Google's driving people to different sites. And they had purchased Blogger by then, so they started to deal with, this is sort of owned and operated properties. You know, where do we throw this line on? Like, what are we liable for in all different countries? And still, like, this is a major problem for YouTube now. It's like the internet is sort of splintering and in many different directions. And in a few years, like, YouTube in Europe may look very different than here and India. And you pick your country and market, it's not all going to look the same.
Here's something I'd love to hear more about. We started hinting at the antitrust conversation. We had Senator Josh Hawley on the show when his book around big tech came out, and he brought up the example of YouTube as like an antitrust concern. So, you know, he's a lawyer, he's very legally about these things. So I'm not quoting him exactly, but he basically was like, if you're a parent, YouTube and Google's control of YouTube is a problem, because that's so much of all of his children's content. But my just immediate reaction was, this YouTube seems to be the big tech company, quote unquote, where I'm just least sympathetic to monopoly claims, just because like we're in the golden age of like digital content. Like, I'm a Paramount Plus subscriber, which makes me a weirdo, but like whatever, like all of Nickelodeon's available there. Like, it actually seems like it seems like when we're talking about monopoly and antitrust with YouTube, we are just concerned that a product manager in Menlo Park could take down a video, but that would be an issue if it was a small business. It seems like digital video online, we're in the golden age of digital video online, and maybe that's coming to a close with, like, you know, the struggles of streaming services and HBO Max and Discovery Plus. But just talk about antitrust in the context of YouTube.
Yeah, I think so. It's a bit more like the issue that's come up for the company around competition and antitrust is in the weeds of their business. It is an ad tech. And that's been mentioned in the Texas AGs leading this antitrust case. It has come up in Europe. So without losing your audience too much, like
go for it. It's our podcast.
You know, Google is not just the biggest search engine, but it has the biggest digital advertising service, and it controls the most of like the pipes on the internet, right? It controls this ad exchange, multiple sides of the market. YouTube sits in there in the sense that, like, you know, you're a Google advertiser, you're buying search is like remarkably easy to also allocate money to video. And YouTube made this decision, I think in 2015, that where they started requiring advertisers that were going to buy on YouTube to go through Google's ad exchange. And that's something that competitors, actual, like not video competitors, not where like users, actually viewers go out and watch video. Cause to your point, that is, especially with TikTok, introduce a lot more competition. But but in the ads world, if I'm, you know, a company, AppNexus, which has since been changed its name and sold around a couple of times, was a chief complainer around this. They're like, oh, this is our business model here, was we're like a competing with this part of Google in its ad tech business. And Google just basically by doing this is like every dollar that's spent on video ads at the time, YouTube is still the dominant video advertising platform. Like there's sure there's competition, a lot of them, that's changing now with Netflix getting the ads, but like most of that is for subscription. And so if you're spending money to sell an ad to someone on a video on the internet, you're most likely going to YouTube. And so that's the crux of the antitrust complaint there too. I think that people have brought up the fact that how often YouTube videos appear in Google searches as an antitrust issue. You know, Google has pushed back on that and said that like our search team, we have like church and state separation, that, you know, we're just promoting the most of, we were promoting the top video, the highest quality video for rankings. Even if that's fair, like YouTube is just because it's so big and so wide. It is, you know, if you're a Vimeo, Facebook video, like any number of competitors out there, it is, YouTube is going to have a leg up there in getting in Google search results. So I think that is, to my mind, the fact that the two biggest search engines in the world have been part of the same company for 17 years. I'm not a lawyer, the antitrust lawsuits thus far have focused on advertisers. And I think that's a little bit lost on the regular voter consumer, doesn't really care about how this machinery and the plumbing works behind the scenes. The argument for like the publishing industry, Bloomberg and others, is we are like, we're beholden to, if Google has monopoly power in digital advertising, right? It can do exactly what happens with a monopoly, right? It can like drive down prices. It can make it harder to monetize as a publisher. And I think that's the viable concern.
So your point is, when we're talking about antitrust, the competitors, quote unquote, are ad exchanges and those different parts. It's not really actually users that are sort of getting screwed here. Let's talk about their competitors then. So Rumble. What's always interested me about Rumble is my favorite sort of Silicon Valley mantra, that like solve a problem for a user. And my beef with Rumble, as someone who's been like adjacent to pitches Rumble has made to creators, is they're not actually describing what seems to be a real problem. They're just making like a very ideological case. They're like, YouTube is like super lib and they're like censorious and we're just not censorious. But it's not clear to me that they are paying better. It's not clear to me that advertisers are even, actually, it's very clear to me that advertisers would most likely flee from your pitch being YouTube is too safe, which is really what you're saying there if you're thinking of it from a business perspective. So just really talk about how it's really, you know, at this stage in the game, now that the conversation is about like speech and censorship and controlling the pipes, how is that really playing out? Because I that's what I struggle with when I think of Rumble. It's not actually, and let's get real for a second. The number of YouTube consumers, posters, big channels who I think seriously need to be afraid of a overly censorious, you know, product manager with their finger too close to the trigger, that's like less than 100 people. Maybe that's I'm making that up as I go along, but that's not a $1 billion business worth of people who need to fear that, is my take.
So I haven't done reporting on Rumble, so I can't really speak to them as a company. I guess maybe it's not necessarily a YouTube product manager, although I imagine maybe once or twice they get involved. But this is like this complex system that people inside the company don't even understand. But there's a trust and safety team.
So I thought it was that simple.
Team. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a trust and safety team that, dictates the policies and then they kind of, you know, train the machines to do this. And then they have a bunch of moderators, some of them that actually work for YouTube. Most of them don't. They work for the Accentures of the world, like they outsource these, and then they're, so that's, it may be someone with a moderator in the Philippines, right? That makes it, I mean, certainly high. Like the Steven Crowder is a really interesting example. So Crowder has, I think, what, 6 million subscribers on YouTube, like isn't the near, not the upper echelon, but certainly sizable. Has been suspended most recently for election misinformation issues. I think a brief suspension. has been talking. I don't know, you might know longer than I, like how long he's been pushing his listeners and audience to Rumble. Mm-hmm. As far as I know, hasn't made the jump, like pulling the cord on YouTube altogether. My assumption there is because it's 6 million subscribers is a lot of people.
There's value like, for you, Stephen Potter, the creator user.
YouTube has continued to monetize him despite some outcries from its staff. So, yes, there are not, like, there are certainly people who have, like, deplatforming is a powerful tool. And these companies tend to deplatform the same individuals. Andrew Tate is a recent example, right? Is under the span of a week, kind of got pushed off the commercial internet. I don't know. I mean, I haven't talked to a single person at YouTube who's like, we're nervous about Rumble. In fact, I would argue, like, counterintuitively, that they kind of want Rumbles to succeed a little bit as an antitrust argument. And like, think about this is happening with TikTok right now.
Yeah.
So Google's head, the SVP, their number two executive, went TechCrunch recently and said, you know, cited these sort of squishy internal numbers they have about the Gen Z using TikTok for search. And it's so funny because like Facebook is out there like literally lobbying people in DC about TikTok and its Chinese ownership and its power. YouTube is doing the opposite where they're saying like pointing regulators to TikTok, saying here's a new company that's come out of nowhere now competing with us on search. How can we be a monopoly if TikTok is competing with us? So I think Google just it's probably a little bit politically savvy. They're like a savvier company. That is a savvy argument. It is, and I do think in that sense, like YouTube is comfortable with competitors like that flourishing. There, I mean, like YouTube is threatened by TikTok, in a real and meaningful way. But I do think I wouldn't be surprised if they want Rumble to. I mean, they certainly don't want a lot of creators like leaving them Rumble. But to your point, like I don't see that as being a risk right now.
Well, it's funny as you're articulating that I'm realizing two things. So it seems like TikTok is right in the sweet spot for Google in the sense that no, like YouTube Shorts, we're competing with TikTok. That's real. It's not a fake thing. It's a real initiative. Like we're actually having to move. This isn't like a fake phantom threat for this company. But unlike with Facebook, it's not wrecking Instagram and it's not Reels, which many people don't take very seriously.
Yeah. I think some of the, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, and then there's the one other thing here too, to the whole point about how why there could be a reason for YouTube in a way, counterintuitive way to like want, like we're not alleging anything, but to want Rumble to succeed is news and politics isn't the primary business that YouTube's actually doing. So I can imagine being Susan Wojcicki and saying, you know what, if like Andrew Tate and Steven Crowder, who are like this minuscule percentage of our business, if they want to go be edgy somewhere else, okay. It's kind of like that's my reaction. I think it'd be different if like the Mr. Beasts and all of like the people who really, so like this is where Twitch, so like Twitch and gaming,
yes,
that's a real thing. So yeah, yes. So speak about this part.
Yeah, I mean, you're seeing YouTuber going out aggressively, like hasn't there's been some reporting around it, but like signing these Twitch streamers, I'm sure paying them a lot of money to come over to YouTube. And so yeah, that is, yes, a competitive front. Twitch is owned by Amazon. Amazon is the biggest threat to Google's core business stuff, like how often people are going to be searching for things. And you just think about how often you search for a product on Amazon rather than Google that. So that is a more meaningful threat than anything else right now. Apple is a meaningful threat too, which we haven't talked about. So Apple has in most recent, the big decision they made was to ban targeted advertising on iPhones and cookies. That has had a marked and clear effect on Facebook's business, and Facebook has grumbled a lot about it. It's had an effect on YouTube too. They just have not, they've not grumbled about it. And two, we don't know because YouTube, they share their top line ads numbers. They don't share anything else. And so we don't have a sense about their margins or its impact there. So yeah, I guess the one thing area where news and politics is important to YouTube is it wants to be a place where people go for events in the same way that Twitter is.
Yeah.
Like that, and it's a little less so recent, but still, when YouTube Live was a product they were pushing, like the book talks a lot about the Christchurch shooting, which was meaningful for a variety of reasons, but one of them was it was live stream footage. And so like that sort of, it footage and people were searching, going on Google and YouTube to find out about this tragedy. Like YouTube wants people to come there like they do on TV, right? There's a big breaking news event. You want to flip on the television to find out what's happening. I think YouTube wants people to go to YouTube to find out what's happening. And so yes, they would be very fine, I think, to lose that the headaches associated with it. But at the same time, it is an important category. And it lends some legitimacy to their platform in the sense that, and this is less of an urgent concern than it was early in their history, but still, you know, they talk about CNN and traditional media to succeed. And they want them posting videos on YouTube and providing more content. So I don't think they're like eager to necessarily cut the entire category.
Maybe this is just conventional wisdom that's wrong, but it seems like traditional media isn't doing too great on YouTube, especially when you are, or is that wrong?
I think there's some, the Condé Nast has had some pretty big success. You know, like, I guess Vox Media isn't really traditional media. I mean, Fox News is, I wrote about this a couple of years ago, like, because YouTube started to shift towards authoritative publishers and traditional media, they tilted the scales in a way. YouTube also, like, Facebook doesn't want to just show viewers MSNBC. Mm-hmm. And so Fox News, I think, and because of Fox News was kind of competing with, like, OANs and Newsmaxes of the world that YouTube, like, didn't, I'm fairly sure, at least they said around the election in 2020, was not treating as authoritative news sources. And so in that sense, I think that's been a big benefit to Fox News.
Interesting. So then if you think of a company like CNN, who's obviously going through its own struggles on 15 trillion different levels that we cannot unpack in a last 5 minute bit of a podcast, like how would a CNN, you're seeing cable numbers just collapse, like how do they think about YouTube, I guess, but this is where the business model being an issue becomes a problem. How do they see YouTube as part of their future, or how should they, or could they?
I mean, I think I can say from YouTube's perspective, because, you know, right now you have the streaming wars like CNN Plus. You know, every single media company is trying to sort of take on Netflix in some ways, and YouTube is trying to position itself. There was a really interesting story in the Journal about this initiative they have called the channels, where like YouTube is in, this is the Journal reporting, is that putting in their app, if you're as Netflix subscriber, you can kind of watch Netflix on YouTube or you and the four other people will subscribe to Paramount.
We happy few.
It is googly. It is, we are going to be like a platform, like literally that's what a platform, right? Like
a bundle. They could rebundle, yes, the cable bundle there.
Yes. And which is YouTube TV is that on connected television. And that's been I think they've been pushing more resources towards it. And YouTube dropped their own original programming, and so I think their pitch, and it's always been like, the book talks about this a lot, how like early on in YouTube, their business team was like, we need TV on YouTube, and they tried to cut deals with CBS and ABC and like everyone under the sun to get them to move. It, you know, wasn't until maybe 2012, 2013 where you started like late night clips, and SNL. And then slowly, like eventually, the news stations. YouTube remains especially for video, the most powerful marketing platform in the world. And like we see that with movie trailers and music videos. I don't have a lot of insight into, you know, like the traditional media companies and the trade-offs they see. But from what I can see, it feels like they're certainly willing to lean on YouTube as an important and vital marketing channel.
I think the last question here to wrap would be, we all see that survey go out every once in a while that shows that like young people 40, 50 years ago, they want to be an astronaut. Now they would like to be YouTubers. A, good thing, bad thing. And B, what do those two examples, astronauts during the space age, then like YouTuber during like the 2020s, like what does that say about like these moments that we're living in?
Yeah, Mr. Beast, as maybe your audience knows, Mr. Beast, probably the top YouTuber right now. I think just this past weekend that it has opened, he's like branched out into
Beast Burger.
Beast Burgers, yeah, you know, in New Jersey, and like tens of thousands.
Picture was crazy. Yes. Just like it was clear at one of these like dilapidated, falling apart post-COVID malls. Yes. You could tell the entirety of this mall was populated by Mr. Beast.
And Mr. Beast makes, I hope for readers that might want to, I think you should buy the hardcover book and then maybe wait for the paperback too. But like Mr. Beast is fascinating to me because he's a very talented and monomaniacal person. But he doesn't look, you know, no offense to Jimmy, like he's not necessarily like a Logan Paul type, right? He's not like people watch Logan Paul in part because he's charismatic and handsome and like
Jake was a Disney star. Like quick thing. That's such a good dichotomy of two different like eras, quote unquote, of YouTube, because Jake and Logan are dudes who could have existed in the old world, but leaned into the new worlds. It's hard to see Jimmy existing in the old world.
Yeah. And there's something about it's the same sort of phenomenon similar to toy unboxing. It's wish fulfillment. Like a lot of his videos are, you know, is giving away money or like doing these sort of elaborate things that he has with his multi-million dollar budget, which is really smart way to use YouTube, like plug money back into making bigger and grander YouTube videos. What does it say that people, you know, our era that wants to be YouTube stars and maybe increasingly TikTok stars? I don't know what it says, but it surely says something. I mean, I don't like, I guess it, you know, it's, it certainly speaks to like the values, broader societal values. I mean, I think it speaks to this sort of remarkable, like the book shows that like in many ways, the company didn't set up, wanted that to happen, but kind of fell into it accidentally and has had some incredibly difficult struggles with stardom and fame and their biggest creators. PewDiePie, I talk a lot about the story of PewDiePie in the book and how that's just like this double-edged sword for the company. I mean, I think I didn't get, the book talks a little about YouTube Kids and the stars there. Ryan Kaji is the highest paid YouTuber in the world, is I think 10 years old now. Like, from everyone that knows him and his family, he's very well adjusted, but we don't know the career of like the child stars on YouTube, what that ramifications are going to be, in part because it's so young, it's so understudied. So I think those are all like really interesting open questions.
You know, it's so interesting just because I'll give my answer to the question. The answer would be that it's about individualism. In terms of like you, but because I actually don't like when people get a little too boomery and they sort of doom and gloom, like, oh, they wanted to traverse the stars and now they just want to do unboxing videos. I think it's about, because hey, like most kids aren't literally saying they're going to become YouTubers. I think what they're really saying is there's something I can just like, that's what we started with. I can just hop on and post this video. Yeah. I have control over things. It's not, you know, we're not doing that. And then I think the other thing too, and just, you know, this is something for people to look into because you're talking about child stars, just all of the Dan Schneider, Nickelodeon, like unveilings about how like disastrous the 1990s to 2000s were when you had that Logan Hollywood version. And it seems like everything's just very under flux now. So I think that's a good place to leave it because this is to quote you from the book, like it flies under the radar. But just like, it's like the iceberg that's submerged. If we're thinking of like the big tech conversation, there's Facebook and there's Twitter and there's Instagram and TikTok. But beneath that, if we're thinking about like how society is literally being shifted, and industries are falling apart, that's here there. So Mark, this is great. Can you shout the book out, the title? It helps people like find it. It's available at our bookshop, but also Amazon and all those other places where we do not get commissions are also great as well too.
Yeah, like, comment, subscribe, out on September 6th. Inside YouTube's chaotic rise to world domination.
Thank you for joining us on The Realignment.
Thanks for having me. It was really fun.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.